Well, Sunday evenings, excuse me, we're in Luke's Gospel. So please come with me to the reading we had, Luke chapter 22, and particularly verses 39 to 46. Now, last time we sat in the upper room as Jesus celebrates the Passover with his disciples. But now, verse 39, we're coming out and making our way to a familiar haunt of Jesus, the Mount of Olives. And as Matthew and Mark record, to a particular place, a garden by the name of Gethsemane. Last time we sat in peace, Jesus seemed in relative ease, but now he begins the deep descent into the deepest ravine of the Valley of Humiliation. Last time we looked at the symbols of Jesus' coming death. This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. Verse 20, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is shed for you. But now the symbols give way to the reality. Verse 44, and being in agony, he prayed more earnestly than his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. Jesus is going to his death, and we shall walk with him. Not as theological tourists, my, that's interesting, or amateur psychologists. He does seem to be under a lot of stress, doesn't he? We go with a profound sense of wonder. We go to worship and to adore. And as we do, Dr. Luke will lead the way, but we'll also draw on Matthew and Mark's accounts as well. So please have Luke 22, verses 39 to 46 open in front of you. We have 3 points, three things to say. Number one, the agony. Verse 39, coming out, he went to the Mount of Olives as he was accustomed, and his disciples also followed him. When he came to the place, he said to them, pray that you may not enter into temptation. Mark and Matthew record that when Jesus came to the place, when he comes to Gethsemane, he stations 8 of his disciples at the entrance of the garden, and then he went forward into the garden with 3 of his closest friends, Peter, James, and John. As someone said, he's like a general deploying his forces for the coming conflict. But to them all, he says, verse 40, pray that you may not enter into temptation. What does Jesus mean? After all, it's a beautiful night. Being the Passover, there's a full moon, and the sounds of the city are now far away. We're resting in the tranquility and peace of a garden. What's the problem? What does he mean, pray that you may not enter into temptation? Well, this is the calm before the storm. In the universe of conflict, we are coming to the epicenter. In that ancient war between Satan and the Son of God, we're coming to that climactic battle. On the next few hours will hang victory or defeat. And so all the powers of darkness are mustering. Satan is about to unleash an onslaught that will have no limits, no restraints. Verse 53, Jesus says, but this is your hour and the power of darkness. And what will Jesus' little flock do when once the shepherd is struck? Pray that you may not enter into temptation. And now with Peter, James, and John at his side, Mark records Jesus' words to them. Now listen to these. This is what he says to his 3 closest friends. Then he said to them, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch. Stay here and watch. Jesus needs his best friends, like he's never needed them before. He says, stay here, please. Watch with me. Be here for me. Don't leave me alone. Doesn't that sound like the words of a man who's afraid? A man who is overwhelmingly afraid. He says, don't leave me. And he says, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Now, who uses language like that? But in Jesus, there's no self-pity, No exaggeration. His words are perfect and perfectly convey the moment. In other words, these sorrows are enough to kill me. And unless heaven upholds Jesus, he will die before he gets to the cross. Jesus' sorrows are unique. Well, leaving Peter, James, and John, Luke records verse 41, and he was withdrawn from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and prayed. Do you pray? When have you prayed your heart out? When have you fallen on your knees before God? A stone's throw away, he falls to his knees and he prays. Can't you feel the urgency, the conflict, as he presses his prayers into his Father's bosom, saying, Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. There's something that Jesus doesn't want to face. And everything inside him seems to scream out, no, not that. Not the cup. Anything but the cup. Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. What is this cup? Why is Jesus so terrified of it? What could be that bad? And yet his will is perfectly in harmony, in perfect harmony with the Father's. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. Jesus continues to love and adore and trust the Father. Now have your eye on verse 43. Jesus prayed. He says, Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. Now Jesus asks, but there's no answer. Jesus knocks on the door, but the door is not opened. Jesus presses his request with the greatest of urgency, but the Father remains silent. This cup cannot be taken away. There is no other way. But in case his Father's silence seems like indifference, he dispatches an angel, verse 43. Then an angel appeared to him from heaven, strengthening him. Do you remember David's words after the death of his son Absalom? He says, oh, my son Absalom, my son, my son. It's a father's love for an unworthy son. But don't we hear a faint echo of the father's love for a worthy son? My son, my son. And feeling, as it were, the pulse of his son weakening under the strain. He can't die now, not here. The Father sends an angel to strengthen him, to comfort him. And all the mystery deepens, isn't it? When Jesus was born, the angels must have blinked with astonishment to see the sovereign Lord of all, a baby, and lying in a manger. But the mystery deepens. An angel is sent to strengthen the maker of the worlds. What did this angel see? What did he witness of that unseen agony? An angel appeared to him from heaven, strengthening him. John Duncan said, on arriving to heaven, he says, first of all, I shall look for the face of my Lord, and then I shall inquire for the angel who came to help my Lord in the hour of his agony in Gethsemane. That angel must have been a great comfort to Jesus. You ever been far from home, and you receive a letter or a text or an email from loved ones, you think, oh, I'm far from home, but I'm not on my own. They're thinking of me. Well, Jesus receives a message from home. He's alone in the garden, and yet he's not alone. The Father is still with him. But any comfort is short-lived. Like a soldier stepping out of the front line to receive supplies, only then to return to the front line and to the conflict. We read verse 43 that having been strengthened, he prayed more earnestly. The conflict here in the garden, it intensifies. Which is why we read verse 44, and being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. Then his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. You think about that. Such is Jesus' agony. Such is the intensity that the blood vessels in his skin rupture. And sweat mingled with blood falls to the ground in great drops, in great clots. Jesus is sweating blood on a cold night. Well, Jesus continues to pray more earnestly, intense, impassioned, agonized entreaties. Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. The writer of the Hebrew throws a light on it. He says, he offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears. He's crying out to his Father again and again. He casts himself upon God. Do you see, there's nothing else he can do but pray. But at last the praying comes to an end, verse 45. When he rose from prayer and had come to his disciples, he found them sleeping from sorrow. Do you think Jesus found that easy? He's about to shed his blood for them. And they're sleeping. His heart is breaking. And they're sleeping. It can only serve, can't it, to heighten his sense of isolation. I want my best friends here with me. Just within a stone's throw, just so I know, I can almost reach out and feel that they're there. But when I come to find them, they're asleep. His friends are not with him. They're not there for him. He goes to the cross alone. But I love verse 46. Does he shout at them? Does he bawl them out? Does he give them a hard time? He's very tender. He's not thinking about himself and how you've let me down. He's thinking about them. Why do you sleep? Rise and pray, lest you enter into temptation. Now, verse 45, we're told that he found them sleeping from sorrow. Christian friends, sometimes it's all too much, isn't it? And we're upset, and we're exhausted, and we retreat into the comfort of sleep. But sleep doesn't make the evil go away, does it? And sleep doesn't prepare us for the temptation that is to come, does it? For the disciples, the storm is about to break. Now is not the time to go to sleep. Now is the time to wake up, get up, and pray. You can't be praying if you're sleeping. They have no idea of the forces that are about to be unleashed upon them. Is there any surprise that we read then when trouble starts? What do? They all forsook him and fled. When the trouble comes, they run away because they didn't pray. Well, Christian friend, are you sleeping from sorrow? Now, sometimes that's okay, isn't it? Sometimes when we're grieved and we're sorry, we are exhausted and we do need a really good sleep. But you understand the point. We are never to let up praying. Luke says a few chapters earlier, then he spoke a parable to them that men always ought to pray and not to lose heart. And there's your choice. We pray or we lose heart. So what are you doing? Are you praying in your trials, in your difficulties, in your sorrows, in your griefs? Or are you losing heart? Or maybe you say, well, I've already lost heart. Well, start praying and you'll find heart again. God will put new heart into you. But whatever you do, however great the sorrows, never let up praying. Tonight may be cool. We may feel ourselves having a moment of calm. We're in the quiet of the garden. But who knows what a day may bring? What satanic onslaughts we may face? What trials and temptations will come with the dawn? Without the aid of heaven, we will not stand. So as we watch Jesus in the garden, one word seems to present itself, doesn't it? And the word is agony. And being in agony. The scene is unique. The conflict is unparalleled. The great Atlantic waves of his passion, they sweep over his soul. Well, point number two, what does it all mean? What's this cup? What's he afraid of? All of us are afraid of something, aren't we? Some of you children, you have fears. Young people, you have fears. When we get older, we have fears. All of us are afraid of something. What is Jesus afraid of? Why does he say to his best friends, you've got to be here for me. Stay with me. Why the agony? Why does everything inside him seem to scream out and say, no, Father, no, not that, anything but that. Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. Jesus shrank from a cup. He calls it this cup. What cup? We read these words, Psalm 75. In the hand of the Lord there is a cup, and the wine is red. It is fully mixed, and he pours it out. Surely its dregs shall all the wicked of the earth drain down and drink. In the ancient world, if you conquered your enemy, do you know what you do to him? You take him and you give him to drink spiked wine. You take his head, you hold his hair, you pull his head back, force his mouth open, and you pour down into his mouth spiked wine. And you drink it down to the very dregs. And then what? Well, then you'd watch. And it wouldn't be long before the drugged wine took effect. And he who had opposed you, he who was your enemy, he would stagger and vomit and fall. And he'd be utterly humiliated before the watching crowd. Inebriated, incapable, wasted. Well, in God's hand is a cup. That's the imagery. And it's filled with strong, spiced, intoxicating wine. It's the wine of his wrath. And God will pour it out. He will pour it down the throats of the wicked. In the hand of the Lord there is a cup, and the wine is red. It is fully mixed. He pours it out. Surely its dregs shall all the wicked of the earth drain and drink down. And the imagery is echoed elsewhere. You can look up at Jeremiah 25, Isaiah 51. But do you see that cup? It's a picture of the outpoured judgment of God upon the wicked. Those who defy God will be forced to drink the cup of his wrath. They'll be utterly abased. Everlasting shame. So what's going on here in the garden? Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. It's the same cup. It's the cup of God's wrath. It's the red, spiced wine of his outpoured judgment. In the hand of the Lord there is a cup. And here in Gethsemane, the Father holds the cup before the Son, for the Son to take it from the Father and to drink it to its dregs. Now, when you start thinking about that, if you're tuned in, your mind's working, you're going to think, well, this is madness. Isn't this a scandal? Here is the Son of God. Here is the one true innocent in all the universe. Here is the one man who does love God with all his heart and soul and mind and strength. And he's to drink the cup of God's wrath? God's Son to be treated, to be numbered among the wicked? The beloved Son to be dealt with as the wicked deserve, drinking the sinner's cup? You wonder, do the Father and the Son know what they're doing? Oh yes. This moment has been planned from eternity past. They've agreed upon it. Here is the wonder of it all. Jesus is innocent, but he's come on a rescue mission. He's come to save the guilty. He's come to save the wicked. And how? By taking their place and drinking their cup. In perfect obedience to the Father, Jesus takes the sins of countless men and women, boys and girls upon himself. He makes those sins his very own, so much so that we read that he who knew no sin is made to be sin. And taking their sin upon himself, he makes himself liable to their punishment. So that in his body, in his soul, he will bear the outpoured judgment of God. Of course he's innocent. How else can he take the place of the guilty? Of course he's a son of God. How else can one life be given for the lives of many? So you see, if in the hand of the Lord there is a cup, the cup of his anger, which the wicked shall drink, then he himself will take it and drink it to its dregs, that the wicked might be saved. So here in the garden, the Father holds the cup before the Son. He can almost taste it. It has the stench of hell in it. He says, must I really drink this? Here's a dam. You know what a dam is, don't you? It's a big wall behind which there's water. Yes, the dam busters, they broke the dam wall. Here's a dam. Every year, the water level behind the wall of the dam rises. That rising water level is a picture of God's anger. I've sinned, haven't I? Some of you could fill in the blanks, couldn't you? You know this very well. I have sinned. I've walked out on God. I've lived and played where God has forbidden. And I forget, but God doesn't forget. Real offences demand a real punishment. God says justice must be done. And so surely and steadily, just like that rising water level behind the wall, so the anger of God against the sinner grows, enlarges, rises. But God in his long suffering, God has held his anger back. He's dammed it up. It's held back until now, until the cross. And so Jesus goes to the cross bearing the sins of the guilty. And what happens? He stands beneath that dam and the hand of the Father breaks the wall, releasing the full weight of his fury and his anger and his wrath, which rolls like a great tidal wave over Jesus' soul. Psalm 88, your fierce wrath has gone over me. Your terrors have cut me off. They have come around me all day long like water. They have engulfed me altogether. And there on Calvary, he's lost, helpless, engulfed. He's drowning in the anger of God. It's a deluge without measure, without restraint. But that's to come. But do you see, here in the garden, Jesus, as it were, he looks up. Have you ever stood looking up at a great building? And you look up and you stand, your nose almost against the wall, and you look up and you can't get over how high it is. What is it where Jesus looks up and he sees this great wall of the dam? And he sees, as it were, the wrath of God. He can even taste it, smell it, the wrath of God that gathered behind it. It's now at the very rim. And he feels the pressure. And he knows the wall is about to break. Now at this moment he can cut and run. When you know there's impending disaster, you can cut and run. Now is his last chance. He can flee the scene. He can run away. Or he can take the cup. And there's no way back. Now do you understand the conflict? Now do you understand why he says to Peter, James and John, don't leave me alone, you've got to be here with me. But he is alone. No one can share this with him. And he's terrified. We're not afraid to say the Lord Jesus Christ is terrified. He's a real man. He's the eternal God, but he's a real man. He's terrified because it's the ultimate nightmare. It means the one thing he fears most, to be exposed to God's hatred of sin, to be cut off, damned, exposed, vulnerable, engulfed in the wrath of God. to feel in his body and soul the incredible density and weight and compactness of God's anger. God's infinite anger. And how can he sustain that? In his naked body and soul. And in the anticipation of it, he is in agony. And even before his body is exposed to the whip and the nail, already he's sweating blood. Then his sweat became as great drops of blood falling down to the ground. Gethsemane means olive press. You get a great stone and you press it down upon the olives till you squeeze everything out of them. And already, isn't he? He's being crushed. He's being broken. And this is just the foretaste of the wrath to come. It is the ultimate nightmare. It means the one thing he fears most. His Father turning away from him. Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. The wonder of wonders. Though he may shrink from the cross, he doesn't shrink from his Father's will. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. He's not a reluctant son. He's always delighted to do the Father's will. And he doesn't seek to be released from it now. This, of all places, is the place to demonstrate his love and devotion to his Father. And so as the cup is held before him, so he stretches out his hand and his fingers tighten around the cup. He will drink it. Not my will. But your will be done. Well, we close number three. We've looked at the agony. We've thought about the meaning. So what's your response? What do you think about all of this? Well, Friday. What was the date on Friday? The 6th of June. So what? Well, 64 years ago, the 6th of June 1944, it was D-Day. When the Allies landed on the beaches of Normandy. And I was reading the account of a D-Day veteran. And as the landing craft pulled up to the beach, that great door that they're all sort of sheltering behind, the door lowered, and he said he had no idea of the chaos and slaughter that awaited him and his comrades on the other side of that door as they stepped onto the beaches. He had no idea what to expect. But he said this, he said the next time he survived D-Day, the next time he went into battle, he said, I was a different man. This time, he said, I knew what awaited me. And therefore, this time, I was much more afraid. When I didn't know what was on the other side, it was okay. I didn't know what to expect. But I'd seen what was on the other side. And next time I went into battle, I was much more fearful. And he survived the next battle. And he said he went on to the next battle. And he was more afraid still of that battle. It didn't get any easier, he said. Do you see, the more you know of what lies on the other side, of what awaits you, the more troubled you become. Now, Jesus goes to his death. It's a death for sinners. It's a sinner's death. It's a punishing death. It's a death under the infinite wrath of God. But you see, this is no reckless undertaking. He knows exactly what lies on the other side. He knows exactly what's going to happen. He knows exactly what he is going to be. He knows what he's doing. And that is why he's so troubled. That is why he is terrified. Because he knows exactly what lies on the other side. And already in Gethsemane, he can taste hell. And already the despair of hell is beginning to take possession of his soul. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. Now, my friend, what of you? Some of you, you're very young. Your landing craft, you may feel, is right out to sea. It's a long time before I get up to the beach. You don't know that, actually. You may be very close to the beach. Some of you are older. You're much closer to the beach, aren't you? Your landing craft is getting much closer, but you don't know what lies on the other side of that door. So are you like that man pulling up to the beach? No idea what awaits you. No idea of the death that awaits you and what lies beyond. Now maybe you feel, well, I hope death won't be painful. Or maybe you feel, well, I hope when that door is lowered, there is nothing on the other side. Or if there is, it'll all be a happy ending. Some of you may have seen Doctor Who last night. Those who died, what a happy ending. It's all happy, everything works out fine. And that's what we hope, isn't it? Sort of a big reunion on the other side, it'll all be happy. But you see, you're moving towards your death and you're hoping it's okay. But you've sinned. And therefore, what awaits you when that door drops down is a sinner's death. And the wages of sin is death. And when the door finally drops, you will see what lies on the other side. And we've got to say, in the light of God's word, what lies on the other side is the ultimate nightmare. If the Son of God is terrified, it is the ultimate nightmare. It's to be exposed naked to God's hatred of sin. It's to be cut off, damned, exposed, vulnerable, and finally engulfed in the wrath of God. It's to suffer in hell, isn't it? As your sins deserve. In the hand of the Lord there is a cup, and the wine is red, it is fully mixed, and he pours it out. Surely its dregs shall all the wicked. We're all wicked. It's all of us. Shall all the wicked of the earth drain and drink down. It's speaking of you. Now look at Jesus. He knows what's in that cup. And look at his reaction. He knows what's coming. Look at his reaction. And we're looking here at the most manly man who's ever lived. Never flinched from anything. A man who's in perfect command of his mind, emotions, body. Look at his reaction. And unless you come to Jesus, the message of the gospel is, you will have to drink that same cup. But you're not the infinite Son of God, are you? You cannot bear the infinite wrath of God in a period of time. You will therefore need to bear it in all eternity. You've no idea, have you, what lies before you. But Jesus has. He sees the cup. He's drunk it to the dregs. And he's done it so that no sinner need ever have to drink that cup themselves. He takes the cup. He holds onto it. He drinks it so that every sinner who comes to him never needs to drink that cup. He takes the cup of God's wrath so that whoever comes to him need never go to hell. He drinks of death and all its bitterness. So that whoever comes to him, they don't have to drink it. And with no punishing death to die, when that door drops, they find on the other side the glories and wonders and joys of heaven. My friend, Jesus in his wonderful love, and it's extraordinary, isn't it, when you stop and think what he's doing and who he's doing it for. 10 minutes with me, you think, I'm not a very nice person. 10 minutes with you, you're not a very nice person. We're wicked. And we don't know the half of it. But of his wonderful love for sinners, he didn't cut and run. What does he do? Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. And it was done. He did take that cup. He did drink it to its dregs. So that he can say to you tonight, come to me, and I'll save you. Come to me. In fact, he says to you tonight, if you want to go to hell, you'll have to go out of your way. Because I stand here with my arms open, welcoming you, saying, come to me. If you go to hell, it'll only be by walking round me, by avoiding the issue. Maybe even now in your head you're avoiding the issue. And you're walking around him. But his invitation is to you to come. To come just as you are, as a sinner, to him. Have you ever prayed? Pray with all your heart. Have you ever dropped down on your knees because you really did mean it? Well, maybe the time is now. Maybe the time is now for you to cry, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Lord, save me. Change me. I've got such a hard heart. I can sit and listen to these things and be thinking about tomorrow. Change me. And forgive me. We sang that hymn, didn't we? I don't know what you think of the tune, but I like the words. Death and the curse were in our cup. O Christ, 'twas full for thee. But thou hast drained the last dark drop. 'Tis empty now for me. That bitter cup, love drank it up. Now blessings draft for me. If you come to Christ, he drinks that cup. So that all that remains to you is the cup of blessing in all its fullness. Do you see? He drinks the cup of God's wrath to save me from the ultimate nightmare. So that when I die, I may fall asleep safely in Jesus.